You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Lester Spence, author of Knocking the Hustle. On the Black Lives Matter platform, Obama's legacy, and more. Also on the program today, Tulsa police shoot another unarmed black man, Terrence Crutcher. Unclear why. Apparently he was one bad dude. Also on the program today, more info. The story of Ahmad Khan Rahami. Apparently, his father had alerted the FBI 2 years ago. Subsequently recanted. Said his son was a terrorist at that time. Meanwhile, Sheldon Adelson spending at least $45 million on Republicans from now until the election. Unclear whether or not he gets naming rights. Gary Johnson insists that Bill Weld is not dropping out. Then is reminded who Bill Weld is. Oh, right. Got it. Debate topics are announced. And, oh, what's this tiny story here? Chris Christie knew about the bridge closing? No. I'm shocked.
Deputized Springsteen.
Countdown begins. When will Chris Christie go to jail? Guess we'll find out. And finally, we get another conservative Facebook. So that conservatives can find like-minded people. I have no idea why. All that and more on today's program. A pretty difficult weekend, to say the least, ladies and gentlemen. Yesterday didn't get much better. Fortunately, no one killed in those series of bombings in New York and New Jersey area. Unclear at this point, you know, all the details, I guess, surrounding. It appears actually that we know a lot about this guy. It's just hard to believe that we know everything there is to know at this point. But as far as the federal officials and city and state officials are saying, they think he acted alone. You've probably heard by now that there was different types of explosives used. It's unclear what he thought about where the locations would be. He's alive. He's not cooperating with police. Obviously, he was shot yesterday in a shootout with police in Linden, New Jersey. The story just came out in the Times that his dad had called the FBI claiming he was a terrorist. And this, I think, was centered around the multiple occasions that Rahami was either arrested or detained for domestic violence incidents. Perhaps it's unclear who the victim was in those situations. But it definitely sounds like there were problems at home. And the father recanted, apparently, his claim. I suspect it had more to do with, like, how do I get my son, you know, something that you hear this story of parents like, my kid's out of control. Do I tell the police to come and arrest him? You know, at the time, it's a 25-year-old kid. I'm not kid, but son. We'll get more information as we go forward. And we will get to that. We will get to that story. We'll also obviously get to the story of Terrence Crutcher. I've seen the video, and, you know, it is baffling as to why this guy got shot. You can't judge everything from this video. The one thing that I think is clear is that very hard to understand how the police thought this guy was a threat to them. Four police officers with guns pulled about 10 feet away from the guy as the guy had his hands on his car. Maybe they thought he had a weapon. But the cops were definitely, you know, seemed scared. But, I mean, that's part of the problem, isn't it? That even the guy in the helicopter was like, this guy seems like a big bad dude. I mean, I can't wait for this election to be over, unless, of course, it's going to be Donald Trump winning. In that case, it's we will get, obviously, into the election and talk about the upcoming debates. Let me first tell you about Texture, though. I've talked to you about it before. This is a great, it's a great app. It's a great deal. You know how you binge watch with Netflix? You know how when you get magazines, you get a half a dozen magazines. I don't know. Maybe you get a dozen magazines. Maybe you get three. Sometimes you read them. Sometimes you don't. I forgot it at home. How am I going to read it? Now it's just stacking up on a big chair that I've dedicated to all my old magazines in the kitchen. I'm not speaking of anybody specifically. My dad does this. Like, literally, I go home and it's just like, it's like hoarders. Yeah. Like magazine titles from years ago. Well, Texture has made it easy to find articles you care about. And I mean, in my instance, okay, I used to subscribe to, like, I'd say four or five paper magazines. The New Yorker, Handyman, Wood. I get Harper's occasionally, Smithsonian, National Geographic for the kids. And half of them, I don't know, just sit around the house. With Texture, I get them all in one location, on my phone, on my iPad. And you can make, you can pull your own stories, read them later. It's awesome. It really is an awesome app. And with all the different magazines that I read, I save money on subscriptions. Best part, Texture's offering my listeners a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/majority. You'll gain immediate entry to all the top magazines, including back issues and bonus video content. You can start binge reading for free right now when you go to texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. Here's some more magazines. I'm going to throw these out there. These are just ones that I read on occasion. There's more than this, but Dwell, Architectural Digest, Consumer Reports, of course. GQ, Macworld, New York Magazine, Smithsonian, Newsweek. You read that Eichenwald piece that came out the other day. Popular Mechanics, The New Yorker, This Old House, Wired. I'm like a Renaissance man. I don't have to buy Wood magazine anymore. I read it on Texture. Check it out. Texture.com/majority. One of the things also we're going to talk about with Lester Spence is going to be the speech that Obama gave this weekend. I mean, David Dayan, and hopefully we'll get to it today, has a great piece in the New Republic about the failure of media outlets and progressive media outlets and progressive activists. We're talking about the story of, like, positive policy developments or activism towards policy developments. Now, we happened to talk about it, or at least I mentioned it a couple of times, and I interviewed Adam Green on Ring of Fire. But we now have 33 senators who have signed on to a resolution for a public option, and not a public option like you contemplate a public option, like we have in the past, where there would be a public option in the exchanges, but basically what we know as Medicare buy-in for everyone. So you have our nominee and 33 senators at last count in the Senate who are actively promoting this. And it's as if, I don't know. I think it's a failure of Clinton not to campaign on this stuff. And it's a failure of, frankly, I think on some levels, you know, everybody associated with the, I think Bernie Sanders should be out there promoting these issues more. May get out there, but I mean, let's do it. You know, do we really need to take 4 weeks off in August? I know. I've talked about Blue Apron before. I had Blue Apron this week. In fact, over the weekend, we didn't eat the Blue Apron at the end of the week. The food lasts for like 5 or 6 days. Chicken thighs. Then we used the broccoli from a different dish. Served it to the kids last night. Pasta and broccoli. But that's not, that's not the best part of it. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, ranchers across the United States. Their seafood is sourced sustainably. The beef is raised humanely. Chickens are free range. Pork is raised naturally. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. So basically what happens is you get a box. They've got freezer stuff in it, you know, cold packs. Apparently, the last couple of days. We ended up opening it by the end of the day. Put it in the fridge. You have all the ingredients for, well, in our case, we get 2 meals a week. I think you can get 3 or 4. I don't know. And it's for less than $10 a meal. It takes maybe 40 minutes from start to end to prepare the meal, cook the meal. Generally, maybe sometimes take 5 minutes more, 5 minutes less. But the meals are delicious. Kids eat them. I eat them. Nikki eats them. It's under $10 a person. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients. Some of the meals available in September, paprika, spiced shrimp and cheddar grits with tomato and sweet corn, spicy hoisin chicken stir fry, eggplant and chickpea tangine. I don't know what that is, but it sounds good. Summer udon noodle salad. I made chicken francese. So I've never done anything like that before in my life. You take the chicken cutlets, you put them in the batter, you put them in the egg, but they give you the egg, they give you the flour, all of it, the whole thing. It was delicious. Check out this week's menu. Get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. blueapron.com/majority. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. blueapron.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Lester Spence. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University and the Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, also author of Knocking the Hustle. Pleasure to welcome back to the program, Lester Spence. Lester, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So let's start with, as a point of departure, on this fairly recently released platform under the auspices of Black Lives Matter. And it is it's a pretty in-depth document and very specific. It has six major, components to it. And I was struck. Well, I mean, first, let me give me your impressions of it. I mean, and I should say one thing that struck me was it feels like that Black Lives Matter has grown in its scope in terms of what it's addressing.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. So at the we know that police violence, is, first of all, police violence is far more than killings, right? They're backed by policies, right? And we know that those violent policies are concentrated not just in Black neighborhoods, but tend to be concentrated in poor urban Black neighborhoods and neighborhoods filled with people of color in general. And then those neighborhoods are also beset upon by a number of other problematic policies, whether it's education and zero tolerance and increased privatization in schools, whether it's the fact that that the cities that these neighborhoods are in have problematic development policies. And what people were critiquing Black Lives Matter activists for was focusing primarily on the killings, and then to a certain extent, primarily on the police without taking a wider approach, understanding that the police is just kind of part of the neoliberal turn. And what they tried to do in this policy document is provide policies for a number of different areas that can help spur local activists to kind of organize around. Because they didn't just present, issue areas. They presented policies. In some cases, they actually presented legislative examples. They talked about how to get these policies implemented, whether it's a matter of legislation or executive order. A lot of thought was put into this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really it's both a radical document, but also an incredibly pragmatic one in terms of, a practical one in that there is, there's recipes here. This is not, is not just simply a list of demands. This is a roadmap. And I mean, so when we hear of, for instance, another killing, this weekend in, Tulsa, and I don't know if you've seen the video of Terrence Crutcher, being shot and killed.
I don't watch that video.
We can't know exactly what's going on in the minds of these police officers or why, but so in the context of a document like this, do we perceive, because it seems to me that this time last year there was a sense of like, look, there's an ongoing emergency where literally this is not metaphorical in any way. This is literally we have unarmed Black people being shot on such a regular basis. Something needs to be done here. This is obviously more expansive. But in that context, do we see these shootings as being the tip of the icebergs, or just simply a feature on the icebergs, as it were?
Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. It's kind of complicated. So what I'll say is that it's what we're doing now with police killings. And it's important to note that we actually don't know. If we can go back now a few years to compare this number to what happened a few years ago, but we really don't know, because police departments don't actually keep data, standardized data, on how many people that actually die in their hands. So we actually don't know longitudinally, you know, whether we're looking at something that's really, really high compared to previous years, you know, like 2000, for example, or whether it's something really low, first of all. But what we do know is that police have basically become, and particularly in metropolitan areas, police have fulfilled one of two roles increasingly, you know, particularly since the 70s. One is they've increasingly served as agents of social control in cities like Baltimore and to a certain extent cities like New York. And then two, they serve as revenue enhancers, right? Revenue generators, like in cities like small towns like Ferguson and elsewhere. And what this incident and others like it have done is put the lens on policing, whereby we can actually look at these other things and connect them and say that this is part of the same general program.
I mean, and the interesting thing about specifically in terms of like social control, and one could argue that they're used as revenue generators, but that in and of itself, too, is a form of social control, right? Because you're taking that revenue from people who it maintains their place in society. But the need, if you will, of our society to rely on the police as for social control is in part a function of the fact that African Americans had been given more political, I guess, power in some respect. I think not even arguably. I mean, in 1965, right? And when you have the Civil Rights Act and you have the Voting Rights Act, there is more political power given. But on some level, there's sort of the flip side of that is taking back some of this power.
Well, I would actually. So Adolph Reed just published a controversial piece from the left in Non-Site, and what he does, although I have problems with the piece, one of the things that I think he does is he argues accurately that this is not just a black thing, right? So we're focusing on black deaths because police disproportionately kill black people, but police aren't only killing black people. And to the extent we talk about police as the agent of social control, and then in the case like Ferguson, additionally serving as revenue generators, those dynamics are race and class dynamics. We're looking at something that is a phenomenon where police are persistently and consistently used against poor populations and black poor populations specifically because they're concentrated in metropolitan areas. I note that because there is a casual way in which we can argue that this is just a black thing. And then even just looking at black communities alone, what looking at this as a black thing puts us in danger of is missing the class components, where we'll say that somebody like me, who's a tenured professor at Johns Hopkins, has the absolute same likelihood of being victimized by police in one way or the other as somebody who lives in Freddie Gray's neighborhood. And we know this actually isn't the case. I mean, we know this by the data, but anecdotally, I've had so many encounters with the police that I should have gotten a ticket, but didn't, that I now am pretty sure I'm on the other side. I kind of interact with police almost like I'd imagine average white person would.
And so, I mean, how does that, I mean, I guess that's always been that's an ongoing question. And that's a large focus of your work is that interaction between race and class there. Right. I mean, and there's a certain there's a feedback loop, it seems to me, you know, race sort of helps to enforce certain class distinctions and vice versa. Talk a little bit more about how that works.
Yeah, because it's complicated, right? So the way I get around it in my own work is I just focus on black people, right? So when I just focus on black people, I can talk about class being real in a way that doesn't come become kind of confusing. But when you add other populations, other racial populations in the mix, it becomes kind of confusing. So let's go back to the Black Power thing. You know, when Black people get power, Black people get power, and they begin to take political control of cities like Detroit, Newark, Cleveland. Later on, city like Baltimore. Those cities end up dealing with white flight, and they deal with corporate flight. And that reduces the ability of the cities to get revenue from their population or to get revenue to provide services. At the same time, the level of concentrated poverty increases because of all that, you know, white and middle class and corporate flight. So it's at that moment that policing ends up becoming a tool of social control in the modern room, where they're dealing with populations that that just don't fit in the economy as the economy transitions from industrial to post-industrial. Now, those populations are going to tend to be non-white and poor, but they're not always non-white and poor, right? So does that make a little bit more sense?
Yeah. And then you've created basically a machine, right? I mean, that is the city basically needs revenue, and the only place they can get it is because of property values and businesses leaving and everything diminishing. It's literally directly taken from the wages of the people who there happen to be working or not working.
Right. So again, in like in the Ferguson case, where most of the where a significant proportion of Black folk are poor and unemployed, you just tax and fine them. You just tax and fine them because you can't get it from like Baltimore. Under Armour just cut a deal with the city of Baltimore for to basically build a third downtown for their corporate headquarters. They're getting like $660 million in tax subsidies. You can't get the taxes from Under Armour, right? You can't get the taxes from Hopkins, right? Because Hopkins is a nonprofit. You have to get it from somewhere though. So you get it from, you know, you get it from low property owners, you get it from Black poor, your predominantly Black and working class population.
You know, one thing that struck me too about the, or another thing I should say struck me about the platform was how conscious it was of intersectionality, particularly in terms of gender and sexuality, least in the and you know the policies that it lists end up, I think, dealing more with the question of class. In sort of a maybe not direct way, but sort of but intersect with it in that way. I mean, what does that? I mean, what does that say in terms of creating a powerful movement? I mean, I guess like is that a? I mean, I imagine. I mean, some of it is obviously just a certain amount of sensitivity. But I mean, included but not limited to those who are women, queer, trans, femmes, gender nonconforming, Muslim, formerly and currently incarcerated, cash poor, and working class, differently abled, undocumented, and immigrant. I mean, there's a real attempt here to sort of to drive a broader to broaden a movement.
Yeah. So what we're looking at is the Black Lives Matter activists recognizing that what it means to be Black is far broader than just being, you know, so police victims are predominantly male, right? And for the longest time, if you look at the leadership of like civil rights or the Black Power movement, you're looking at a movement that was dominated by men. Even though women in a number of cases were the ones doing most of the work. And what we have now is a dynamic where people are realizing that there are a lot of Black folk who are members of the LGBT community that are actually catching hell, and not only catching hell, but they're taking leadership roles. There are a number of different ways in which folk who are Black and Muslim are being subjugated, and
any movement that proclaims to be about Black people has to actually take into account all those different ways, all those different kind of ascriptive identities that Black people have, and you can't just ignore them anymore. So I think that what they're doing on that line, on that end, is absolutely wonderful. To be fair, I believe that we should still be privileging class, because even if you take those individual ascriptive identities, people who are poor within those identities are going to have a far harder time, you know, having decent lives than people who are not. But with that said, I think what they're doing represents a significant improvement upon previous generations.
So, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, it's basically the canary in the coal mine type of situation. Having an intersection of these different identities or experiences make you that much more vulnerable to anything that is happening within society, I guess.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Now, again, it gets kind of complicated, right? So, for example, when we talk about gender, often we're talking about the intersection between being Black and being a woman, but being Black and being a man, being a man and being Black, it doesn't quite work the same as being a man in general, right? So even though women are Black women are the fastest rising population in the prisons, by far the largest, by far there are far more Black men in prison, and that has a significant effect on Black men's income. That's not usually calculated when you look at data. Black men's employment level, when you look at data, we know that this stuff is going on in the schools, right? So with the zero tolerance policies affecting kind of men and women differentially. So yeah, it becomes complicated, but it's better to actually have that conversation than to work on the assumption that to be Black automatically means you're talking about Black men.
So what do you think happens next with this platform? And the platform's out there. I mean, what's the next step in terms of implementing, building movements around these issue sets?
Well, so the next step I'd imagine would be, because Black Lives Matter is still kind of, it's still really decentralized. So the next step will be on individual kind of cells of Black Lives Matter activists to take proponents of it, to take components of it, and try to implement them in their own communities. And then I'd imagine at some point in time, people who are working on similar areas in different places can lash their attempts up to try to get more of a national purchase.
Yeah. I want to turn here. I mean, and part of that, I guess, is as it starts becoming more national. Now, of course, locally, it's a different story. But as it becomes more national, this coming election certainly may have implications for any of these things having a hearing. I mean, I'm curious as to your take on this, but I want to first play this clip from President Obama this weekend. He was speaking to the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, and he got pretty animated in terms of arguing that people should get out and vote, and tied it into his own personal legacy, as well as, I think, to be fair, a broader progressive agenda that he ostensibly has started. Here's a clip of that.
So that they could pull that lever. So if I hear anybody saying their vote does not matter, that it doesn't matter who we elect, read up on your history. It matters. We've got to get people to vote. In fact, if you want to give Michelle and me a good send-off, and that was a beautiful video, but don't just watch us walk off into the sunset now. Get people registered to vote. If you care about our legacy, realize everything we stand for is at stake. All the progress we've made is at stake in this election. My name may not be on the ballot, but our progress is on the ballot. Tolerance is on the ballot. Democracy is on the ballot. Justice is on the ballot. Good schools are on the ballot. Ending mass incarceration, that's on the ballot right now. And there is one candidate who will advance those things. And there is another candidate whose defining principle, the central theme of his candidacy, is opposition to all that we've done. There's no such thing as a vote that doesn't matter. It all matters. And after we have achieved historic turnout in 2008 and 2012, especially in the African American community, I will consider it a personal insult, an insult to my legacy, if this community lets down its guard and fails to activate itself in this election. You want to give me a good send-off? Go vote!
So there it is. It's he would take it as a personal insult. Give me your reaction to that, Lester Spence.
Well, one, analytically, he's right. That is to say that Trump represents a clear improvement to everything that progressives stand for. And there are people who are suggesting that there is no difference or there's little difference between Trump and Clinton. And those people are absolutely wrong. And I say that, and I'm pretty sure I'm voting for Jill Stein. But I can cast a vote for Jill Stein and simultaneously recognize that there is a big difference between Trump and Clinton. And if Trump would be, if Trump were to be elected, we would be in more danger than any time I have ever been in as an adult. And even going back to when I was a kid, and I was born in 69. So on that, analytically, he's right. But the way he gets there is deeply, deeply problematic in that he's consistently, as he's been president over the past two terms, wrapped up the black agenda in his own body, right? So in that case, he's saying, to do my legacy justice, you need to get out the vote. When what he should really be saying, and if the CBC was a bit more accountable to the black people who tended to vote for them, what he would really be saying, what the CBC would really be saying is, it's in your interest to vote because of this, 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 and this, and this. It's not, you know, you shouldn't vote because a group of elites are concerned about their legacy. You shouldn't vote because, you know, we want to give Obama and his wife a good send-off. You should vote because it's in your interest. What that indicates on Obama's side is that he still has kind of a deep disdain for regular people in general, and some would argue black people specifically. Right? Like, I mean, why would he, under what circumstance would it be logical for him to make an argument where somebody like Trump is running for president? Like, I want you to vote against Trump because it would basically make me look good. I mean, that just doesn't make sense.
Let me offer a theory and get your take on it. I mean, I agree, and I actually think this is sort of indicative of a greater problem in terms of what we've seen from Clinton, frankly, in terms of articulating an affirmative message that goes beyond. I mean, the only thing I can think, I'm not sure that I actually agree with this, but the argument that Obama has always operated under the belief that to articulate policies that are specifically oriented to black people, or that specifically makes it toxic within our society, and that it's only safer for him to be sort of a metaphor for all those things. I mean, like, you know, even when he's talking about sort of these broad principles, and at one point in the speech, he says, especially in the African-American community. I mean, he's at the CBC. We know what he's talking about.
Right.
But he still has to sort of make it like all these things happened. And particularly, you know, as if it was a side feature. But that idea I think there is some validity, whether I agree with it or not, to the idea that black folk have projected onto Obama a lot of things that encompass a lot more than just him, but they come out in some, you know,
yes,
some form of pride in some way that he represents things that maybe he doesn't necessarily represent, but it makes one feel better if they do feel that he does.
Yeah. Yeah, there is that part in there. Although I think you're right about the first your assessment about kind of what he feels like he can and can't say is kind of on the mark. But this is what it misses. You take something like Clinton's policy, and it's important to note that Bernie and folks on the left pushed her to adopt it. Clinton's platform her platform idea about making public education free for people making $125,000 and less. So if that policy gets implemented, I mean, granted, it'd be hard, but if your kid gets accepted to a school like the University of Michigan, go blue, if you made $125,000 or less, I think that's the number, your kid would go there for free.
Yep.
Right? Now, that policy is universal, right? It was means tested, but it's not race tested. Everybody, a whole bunch of black people would benefit from that policy, right? Obama could have theoretically used a set of policies that Clinton was actually supporting and argued that black people would disproportionately benefit. And instead of arguing you need to do that to basically make sure I go out on a good note, right? But still, he has this, he believes, I think he does understand that black people are kind of wrapped up in him. But black people aren't just wrapped up. Like, black people tend to be pretty sophisticated in their voting choices. And that's really not in him because his politics are bad in this way and other ways. But I wish he could have spoken in that.
Yeah. And I would say it's a complaint I have, too, with Clinton. I mean, I think, you know, that we've seen this complete absence of promoting these policies, I guess there's still this sort of allergy in the Democratic Party, even to sort of articulate it in the context of a general. And we're looking at a general election where I don't think that Donald Trump has criticized a single policy point held by anybody. I mean, short of like the height of a wall.
Yeah.
So there's certainly room to do that. And there's certainly room to do that for the president in that context. And it does feel like he, you know, there is an extension of something that we saw from the president throughout his two terms, it seems to me, that is the respectability politics on some level. I mean, it seems to me that the argument is there's some measure of personal responsibility. Like, instead of me having to make a pitch as to why you should come out, I'm just saying I'm going to be offended if you don't. I think he's got that reversed, it seems to me.
Yes, that's it exactly. And here's where, you know, to the extent you're talking about Clinton and Obama being cut from the same cloth, both of them are kind of DLC type, are the Democratic Leadership Council type Democrats, right? They're neoliberal, they're centrist at best, and they don't tend to believe that regular people have the right to determine their own policies, and that the best way, and they tend to believe that the best way to kind of speak to them is to speak down to them.
All right. So let me just turn to something you said earlier when we were talking in the context of Trump and Clinton being different. Why are you voting for Jill Stein if you see that dramatic difference?
Well, so I don't see my vote as part of a broader strategy, right? Now, if I saw my vote as part of a broader strategy And I lived in a state that was likely to that, you know, in which the vote was contested, then I'd be if it was part of a broader strategy, I would I cast a vote for Clinton in a second, even though I don't like her. If I thought the vote was a bit more contested in the state of Maryland, I'd think about it. But I'm casting my vote for Jill Stein just because I remember the Clintons. It's not really rational. It's just because I remember the Clintons. I remember the 90s. I blame if there's any single political official, I blame for NAFTA. I blame for the rise in federal incarceration rates. I blame for gutting welfare. I blame the Clintons for that. And Hillary Clinton was not just his wife. She actually worked with him on this policy. She supported this stuff. And I just, me as an individual voter, I just can't pull the trigger. But again, Trump is deeply problematic. So the more I think about it and the more I hear bad arguments from the left suggesting that they're the same when they aren't, the more likely I'm going to cast my vote for Clinton when it comes down to it.
I mean, let's talk about that, because I think this, you know, I feel myself to be more or less in the same position in terms of the fundamental lack of understanding of the way that power and politics work, and the idea that somehow electing Donald Trump would be a net positive for anything in any time frame. And I think maybe this is becoming, you know, and this is nothing, I'm not saying anything new, and it's not saying anything particularly profound. I think most people probably who are hopefully listening to this say this. It's becoming the focus of this is becoming beyond 2020 at this point, now that we're 6 weeks out. I mean, I think, just for the sake of those few people who have either claimed that they're quit listening to my program because I say stuff like this or are about to, but make that case about what I've just said. I mean, so from your perspective, because you look at these issues, the issues of race and our society through the lens of both economics and power, in a way that I think that seems to be the angle that you are trying to always to pursue. Describe it from that sense.
So I'll try to quickly tackle two arguments. Like, one argument is that if Trump gets in office, we're more likely to have revolutionary change because people kind of don't, you know, people won't be able to take it any longer. That idea evinces a fundamental misunderstanding of how revolutions actually take place. It's far more likely that we'll have a counter-revolution instantiated than we'll have a revolution. Right. So one way to think about it quickly, I remember when gas was rising up and people said, well, if gas hits $4, people riot in the streets. Gas hit $4. It didn't happen. Why? People carpooled. People walked to work. People stayed home because there were no built in institutions that could actually generate the type of revolutionary change that people would have wanted in this moment. There were no political opportunities which to take advantage of to make people say, oh, okay, this gas is going up higher because of X, Y, and Z. Hence, you need to go out in the streets, right? Revolutions are not simply the product of bad actions or distasteful actions or distasteful political actions. They're the function of political opportunities, political institutions, and other stuff. Right. So if Trump gets in office, it's not going to be a revolutionary change unless you're talking about a counter-revolution where we're going back to the 50s. Right. That's the first thing. The second thing quickly is that people misunderstand if Trump gets in office, the presidency and the Congress will be run by not just the Republican Party, but the deep, deep right wing of the Republican Party. And every single budgetary decision they make will have a carryover effect in the future. So if they gut, for example, spending on what little spending we have on urban issues, for example. That stuff, once you've taken compound interest into account, will end up causing us to be in a far, far, far deeper hole than if we had somebody who was just maintaining and taking that same amount going forward, right? I remember, and this is somebody I really respect, but I won't say this person's name on the air. Somebody argued that Congress under Trump would be just the same as a Democratic Congress under Obama. And I'm like, you don't really understand. The Congress, as it is, Obama's Democratic Congress was a combination of left-leaning Democrats who are minority, centrist Democrats who are a significant number, and then what remaining conservative Democrats that were left. So it was really difficult to organize them around an agenda. The Republican Congress, on the other hand, is all on the right. So if Trump actually gets in office, all of their right-wing policies they'd be able to implement, all of them, because they have no conflict. They're all on the same ideological side. This is like civics 101.
Right.
I mean, it's really civics 101. So when somebody actually says, well, you know, a Trump Congress will be the same as an Obama Congress, they obviously know very little about how Congress actually functions. And it's hard to say that to adults who are politically sophisticated when it comes to political ideology, but that's actually the truth.
And that's not to mention the Supreme Court, which is also going to have sort of generational effects.
Yes. So they're waiting. Right. So and this is actually radical what the Republican Republicans actually did. Where we've been now, when did Scalia die? Scalia died like several months ago.
It's almost 6 months ago now. I think he probably died sometime. I mean, I have it marked in my calendar.
Nice. That should be like a national holiday. I shouldn't have said that, but it's true.
I've said worse.
We've had a Supreme Court. We've had a 4-4 Supreme Court for several months. They've just let that position lie fallow. If Trump is elected, they're going to put somebody to the right of Scalia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's not just what the Congress can do as far as legislation, peeling back legislation, slashing budgets. It's what the Supreme Court can do as far as establishing law. To go back to police killing, one argument that my colleague Daryl Scott made, Daryl Scott's a historian of Howard, brilliant. He argued that a lot of this stuff could be taken care of if we just repealed Graham versus Connor. Graham versus Connor is a law case that basically establishes the precedent that a police officer can use fear of his or her own life as a justification for killing. If we repealed that, then it'd be very hard to kind of for a police officer to just wantonly kill a black person or any poor person and use fear as an excuse, right? If we appoint somebody to the right of Scalia, the possibility of that for our lifetime, right, for at least the next 20, 30 years goes down the toilet without a real, real struggle. I mean, this stuff is 101. This is 101. I don't like Clinton. I can't stand the Clinton legacy. I think what they've done has been absolutely horrible. But there's no way I would ever make a claim that those two people are the same. Trump and Clinton are the same. That is just more the same. It's like people who are making that argument should be precluded from speaking about politics in the media.
I couldn't agree more to that. But let me just dig into one more aspect that you'd mentioned about the lack of institutions that were available to respond, in your example, to the $4 a gallon of gas. Just talk briefly about where those institutions, where they flourish. I mean, I contemplate the idea of like a George Bush or a Donald Trump presidency, and the idea a year and a half ago that Black Lives Matter activists were going to interrupt a forum between the Democratic primary candidates. It seems to me the oxygen available for that to happen in a defensive position with a Republican-controlled government is virtually nil. That on some level, I mean, give me your sense on that. And,
So unions are deeply unions themselves have moved to the center, right? Of center, if not the right, right? The unions are not the but I'm just going to use them as an example. Union power is a partial function of legislation and then appointments on the National Labor Relations Relations Board, NLRB, right? If Trump gets in office, he controls a significant number of those appointees. And those appointees determine, help determine, along with legislations, what unions can and can't do, what they can and can't fund, you know, how they can and can't collect dues, right?
The latest ruling, just as an example, was about franchises and whether or not each individual, whether the corporate McDonald's is responsible for the treatment of their workers in each franchise across the country. And that's purely a National Labor Relations Board assessment that will be tested in the courts. But that's where it starts. If they don't make that determination, then the question as to whether or not McDonald's as a corporation has any responsibility for the way that their workers are treated goes out the window. Just as an example. Continue.
That's perfect. Right. So to the extent the union represents at least a piece of that revolutionary pie, right, if they don't have the ability to use their resources because of NLRB decisions, then that takes away the oxygen for potential revolutionary change. Right. So and then you could think about it. So one of the most important reasons why Baltimore is such a hotbed now of political activism is because of the work of one specific radio show host who's here in Baltimore. That specific radio show host got a significant chunk of his money indirectly from unions. The unions were scared of the Supreme Court decisions, and as a result of that, they pulled their money from that and other shows to focus on the Supreme Court attack. That show is now under in trouble beyond this year, right? So even if we say it's not the union and there are all these little media spaces where people get, like, you know, like your show, where people can talk and people can exchange ideas, but they get their resources from somewhere. And if those nonprofits are constrained because of federal policy, then the ability of those media entities to exist becomes weakened. So again, if we have to understand the fundamental aspects of how revolutionary change occurs and then how political change occurs in general, it's like people believe that if we just get the right combination of rhetoric or the right person in office, then the whole world's going to change. It doesn't work like that. If you want to see something like a Jill Stein tendency take control, you don't argue that Trump and Clinton are the same when they're not. You don't, and maybe you don't even vote for Stein as president. What you do is start fighting at the local level, either to make a party like the Green Party be important or to take over the Democratic Party so we can then create more and more platforms where a majority of American citizens can come to take our common sense. That's it. That's what our struggle is supposed to look like.
I'm going to take a guess. You were talking about the Mark Steiner show. And is that possible?
Yes.
Yeah. So people should check that out. It's steinershow.com. Maybe there's some support.
He is the most important, the most important media figure in the city of Baltimore. And a lot of the political change that we've had over the past several years doesn't come without him actually giving people a platform. It's him. And then there's everybody else.
All right. Well, people can check that out at thesteinershow.com. Lester Spence, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. The book is Knocking the Hustle. We'll link to that at themajority.fm. But thanks so much again for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And next time I'll be in the office, just call me there.
We'll talk to you later. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Peace.
All right, folks. So we had a little bit of technical difficulties. You're listening as a podcast. You would not even know it. I should have even brought it up. Maybe we'll cut out that part. Maybe we won't. The number is 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of this program. A reminder. And yes, we are working. I swear to you, I'm actively working on a new methodology to connect people to the show, guests in particular. But your support makes it possible for us to improve our technology. Kelly and I are already talking about redoing the website, making it cleaner, more functional. Where Matt and I are talking about cleaning the office.
I'm the person to talk to about
buying
that.
A broom, getting a dustpan. All of these things we have a broom. We do have a broom. I'm not going to lie. We don't have a dustpan. So let's put that on the list. You can support this program by becoming a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Literally just pennies a day. I mean, it would be annoying to carry around that many pennies, but you could do it. I wouldn't advise it. But it's your support that keeps this program going and growing. And I want to thank our members. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon or you buy it from Jet.com, head over to MajorityReportKickback.com, click through the link, the Jet or the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your stuff through that link, we get a kickback. My understanding is with Jet, it's going to stay a separate company. It's going to be owned by Walmart, but it's going to stay a separate company. So their business practices, at the very least, will remain the same, at least for the time being. So Jet.com users, don't despair. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of the program. Also, we'll take your IMs. We'll be right back after this.